from the studios of WYCR at the University of Indianapolis. I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Hey, welcome to the program. You know, the death of someone we love is one of the hardest challenges we face. Regardless of our spiritual or religious practices, the loss of a child, parent, spouse, sibling, grandparent, or significant person in our life can send us reeling. Well, Diana J. Ensign's new book, Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing, offers candid accounts from people across the United States whose lives have been touched by death. Despite the nature of the sorrow, each person's story imparts heartfelt life lessons learned through an arduous journey of grief and self-discovery. Diana Ensign is the author of Traveling Spirit, Daily Tools for Your Life's Journey. She's a frequent speaker and workshop facilitator on mindfulness, compassion, grief, and healing. She writes the Spirituality for Daily Living blog found on her website, and that's at DianaEnsign.com. Diana, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I enjoyed your first book. I love this book. It's filled with so many powerful stories. Why don't you share, where did the vision for this come from? Why this book about death, dying, and grief?
Well, actually, there's a couple of backstories. My mm-hmm. own father passed away in a drunk driving accident, so that's my own history. Mm-hmm. But after the first book, which talks about that loss, I wasn't sure what my next project was going to be, and I was asking for guidance and trying to figure it out. And then one night, I actually had a dream, and it was very vivid and very clear. And in the dream, I heard someone say, your next project's going to be on loss. And in the dream, I actually saw someone that I recognized, but I had never met her. And she had been at an event I was at about a year prior. Her name's Michelle, she did music for the event. Uh-huh. And it was acoustic guitar, no words, and I was busy organizing the event, so I actually didn't pay a whole lot of attention to what she was doing. I never talked to her. But she was in the dream, and I had the email communications because of the prior event. And so when I woke up, and I mean, this was a vivid dream, obviously, yeah, and so I sent her the email, and I said, you know, I had this dream. I'm supposed to be working on loss. I don't know why you were in it, but, mm-hmm. you know, would you like to get together for coffee?
So you were heading into Robert Moss territory. Actually getting a vision for your book in a dream. I love that.
Yeah, I didn't know. But, yeah, and I, you know, when I hit the send, I thought, oh, here we go. You know, what if she thinks I'm crazy? Uh-huh. But she replied right away, and she said, it's the anniversary of my parents' death. Both of them had died from AIDS. Hmm. Please come over to my home. I'd love to talk to you.
And you didn't know that?
No, I had no way of knowing that. Yeah. No way of knowing. So right from the get-go, I feel like I was led, and I think maybe that helped me because it was a 3-year process and it was somewhat challenging and difficult. And then I would remember the dream and say, nope, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I had no doubt right from the gate that this is what I was supposed to be working on.
Yeah. You interviewed close to 50 people.
I did.
Mm-hmm. And I believe the age ranges were young to very old, right? Mm-hmm. Vast age range.
Yeah. I think Sophia was a freshman in college, about 19 years old. Right. And Ralph, who had lost his wife, he was, I believe, 89. Mm-hmm.
So did a lot of these people and their stories cross your path? Did you know about them? How did you choose to interview mm-hmm. all these variety of people?
Yeah, well, Michelle was the first one. And while I was interviewing her, when we finished, she said, you really need to talk to DeLynn. DeLynn had just lost her son, mm-hmm. and Michelle had been working with her on some Reiki. And I had never met DeLynn. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, I'll talk to her. And mm-hmm. I met with DeLynn, and she told me about her son, and she was my second story. And then she said, you really need to talk to my daughter because sibling grief is a whole other area, and she may have another perspective and some other things to offer. And so then I called Vanessa, who's in the prologue, and then it just kept going from there, just person after person.
And what I also loved about this book is mm-hmm. you chose to ask each of them similar questions. Mm-hmm. Share what some of those questions were.
Yeah, I really, only a couple of questions. I said, what has helped with your healing? Mm-hmm. And they talked about that. And another question I asked a lot of people was, did you have any spiritual or religious practices that helped you through your grief process? Mm-hmm. And then for some people, I ask them to tell me a favorite memory of the person to sort of honor the loved one.
Mm-hmm. In terms of how the loss affected them or even their spiritual practices, did you notice a common thread or was it literally just a variety depending on the individual?
As far as what?
Well, in terms of how they perceived and how they were handling the death of their loved one.
There were some common threads, and then there was also a huge variety. So I guess the answer is both of those things are true. So, for instance, almost everyone said that we handle grief differently, mm-hmm. And that talking about it for them was helpful mm-hmm. and healing. Mm-hmm. And then as far as the individual stories, some people found faith practices helpful. Mm-hmm. Some did not. Mm-hmm. Some actually found their faith practices harmful if the particular organization was not supportive or comforting of the loss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, such as some fundamentalist churches really frown on suicide, for example. I would mm-hmm. think that would be an example. Not that it's an example in your book, but that has happened with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, exactly.
I love quotes, mm-hmm. and I'm always intrigued why authors choose certain quotes. And one of the first quotes you have in your book, it's in the prologue, is a beautiful quote that I've never read before by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And it says, "Guess now who holds thee? Death, I said, but there the silver answer rang, not death, but love."
Mm-hmm.
What was it about that quote that spoke to you that you put front up in your book?
Well, I like poetry, first of all, but this whole book, it's called Heart Guide because it is heart wisdom and heart knowledge, and that's where love resides. And so that's one of the themes throughout the whole book is the love we carry for those who have passed that helps us through the hard times and mm-hmm. helps us connect to one another.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you found, and we'll go through some stories here soon, but mm-hmm. a lot of people just handled grief differently.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any surprises in the close to 50 people that you interviewed for you?
Lots and lots of surprises. Sometimes I think the surprising thing is just how simple little things can help us. So mm-hmm. a lot of people mention pets as being very comforting, mm-hmm. bringing a pet into their life after a loss, or the concern that once the pet died, they would lose another piece of that person that mattered to them because it was a pet of the loved one. And I hadn't thought about it that way. And then music, you know, lots of people, when you ask them a favorite memory, it's, just singing in the car or playing guitar on the beach or a family vacation. You know, those very simple things are healing and helpful. It's not big, large, complicated things. I guess that was surprising to me.
Yeah. Was, not to put you on the spot, but was there a particular story that when you interviewed the individual, because this was a period of time, you did this,
mm-hmm.
you found that it hit you the hardest, like, oh, wow, it just stuck with you. Was there any one or two stories like that?
I would think every single person I met with, their story hit me and stuck mm-hmm. with me. And I should have said that right in the beginning, that it takes a lot of courage mm-hmm. for people to share such intimate stories of loss. And so I do want to thank everyone who shared their stories. And there were people who did not want to share their stories publicly, even after I talked to them, and they withdrew their stories. And mm-hmm. so that's a reminder that these are really difficult and tough topics. So, so to answer your question, everyone touched me, and a lot of them I went home and cried. They're human stories, our stories of loss. You know, the one that I always want to make a commitment to bring up mm-hmm. Whenever I talk about the book is mm-hmm. the mom who is anonymous.
Yeah.
I
want to get to that story because that's in the first chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, before we go to break, mm-hmm. You have all these stories. There's so many beautiful, gut-wrenching, but also inspiring stories in this book. Mm-hmm. You have it broken down in the chapters. Did you find that it just naturally happened with the variety of stories, like this group tended to fit under this topic, that kind of a thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did sort of evolve. I would sit down with someone, and, I'd ask them those two questions, and some people would say to me, what you're asking me isn't what I want to talk about. And I would say, just share with me what you think would be helpful for someone to know.
Yeah.
And so that might be, for instance, the family imploded during the funeral or during caretaking. And that, after I got four or five people saying, the caretaking was an extra added level of anguish, you know, then I have a chapter on caretaking that I never anticipated. And so that is how some of the chapters developed, just based on what people wanted to share.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me is you got this book in a dream. That's pretty cool, first off. Mm-hmm. But it literally took off on a life of its own.
It really did.
As you interviewed more and more people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would imagine you could have kept going, too. When did you know, okay, I need to stop right now because there could be 50 more people I could interview.
And I have had people come up to me and tell me their story since the book has come out, which I'm very grateful for.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's a delight to have Diana Ensign make a return visit to this program. She's author, speaker, facilitator. Her newest book is out, Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing. We'll be sharing some of those stories. But first, here's a word from our sponsors.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. Thank you for joining us today. Diana Ensign is in the house today. She's author and speaker, facilitator, gifted author. Loved her first book. Her second book is just out now. It's called Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing. You call chapter one an unexpected jolt. Explain that a little bit, and then let's go into Anonymous's story.
Sure. So unexpected jolt, that's when grief totally blindsides us. Someone passes away that we were not expecting or anticipating. So, for instance, a plane crash or a car crash or overdose or suicide. Mm. You know, there's no prior preparation, and so we don't have a chance to process it before it happens.
Yeah. The story that we wanted to highlight, because you have quite a few in each chapter, was the one that really tugged on my heart just because of what not only her son went through, but what she went through, and that's why she's anonymous. She wanted to stay anonymous. But let's talk about her story now.
So the anonymous mother in chapter one, her son had mental health issues, bipolar. He also had addictions. And so what happened in her story is, like, you know, a lot of families dealing with addictions, there was rehab, there was, you know, relapses and all of those challenges. Mm-hmm. And then she got a call. I guess her daughter had found on Facebook an obituary. That is how her daughter learned of this, of her brother's death. And that's also how the mother learned. There was an obituary, and her son, she called the police to find out what had happened. She was living out of state. Mm-hmm. And they said, you're just going to have to come. We can't tell you over the phone.
Yeah.
And then she called the, I believe it was the coroner.
Yeah, because she told the police, and I can almost imagine her anguish. Mm-hmm. I'm 11 hours away.
Right.
My son just died. You've got to tell me something.
Yeah, I mean, she was frantic. And she finally got a hold of the coroner, and he relayed to her what happened. And that's a hard thing to talk about. He slit his throat. And that's what she learned on the phone. And then she had to travel to where he had been and go through that process. Mm-hmm. And what happened is, because it was a suicide, her former spouse has not told the family what happened because of his religion. There's this fear of judgment or it's a sin, know. And so, so he has not told anyone. And because he has not told anyone what's happened, she cannot tell anyone, and that's why she's anonymous. And, you know, when I asked her, well, what helped with your grief, she said, you know, what helps me is talking about it, except that no one will talk to me. Mm-hmm. And she said even when she tries to talk about it, you know, people can't hear it. Mm-hmm. And she said she talked to a friend, and the friend said, well, that's hard for people to listen to. And she said, I'm the one living with it. I'm handling it. Mm-hmm. The least they can do is listen. Mm-hmm. And so this story's in here. I think it highlights what we as a society and family and church community, what we can do better is we can listen to people and we can say, share your story with me. You know, I want to know about this person. I want to know what they were like. I want to know what you loved about them, and not make them feel like we're going to judge them or there's going to be stigma because of the way the person died.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We just have to show support regardless of how the person died, because this person, the mom, is suffering and her story matters. And so I just...
Her story matters, mm-hmm. and all I can think about are the increase in suicides of adolescents these days.
Right.
So there are more and more moms and dads who are probably silent about it too, but they need to hear her story.
Right. And she said, her very last sentence in the story is, she says, I always ask myself what good could come of something like this. It's brutal. It's sad. I don't know if anything positive will come out of it. I hope it does. That would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And so the positive thing would be taking her story and using it as a call for all of us to be compassionate towards everyone who has lost someone and allow them to share their story openly.
Mm-hmm. Because of her situation, wanting to be anonymous, what was she doing in terms of any self-care for herself?
She lives in a rural area. She doesn't have any self-care. That's another problem. She says the way that she kept going, and this is what I mentioned earlier, she says, my dog saved me initially and still to this day. So she trains them. She works with them. Her pets give her a reason to get up in the morning and keep her from falling into depression.
Yeah.
And she also has her faith, and that helps her also.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. The second chapter is all about navigating grief's currents. It's the need to fully grieve, that rituals do matter. And we want to share the story of Donna Robinson in this one. So talk about, first of all, the various people whose stories fit under that heading about learning how to navigate through grief.
Yeah, there are a number of stories in this section where the person has a loss, such as a sibling or parents or a child, and they're not given the opportunity to fully express those feelings, either because the family doesn't want you know, the children to be burdened with that, or because the person is out of state when the loss happens, you know, a variety of situations. And for Donna, she lost her daughter. Again, it's a suicide situation. So the background for her story is, and this is another hard one. These are not easy stories. My mom is the first person who bought the book, and I said, well, what did you think? And she said, I read one story a day. just one.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah.
it's.
Because it's intense.
It's intense, and there's a lot of helpful wisdom and a lot of courage, but it is a tough topic. So Donna has a daughter named Carol, a very fun-loving, gregarious, comedic talent, gymnast. When she was sharing her story with me, it actually reminded me of Robin Williams, because such a light and so fun and funny and, you know, bringing people together and making them laugh.
Yeah.
And she suffered from depression, and the family did not know that. You know, so that that depression, you know, is going on internally, and so we don't always know what someone's carrying.
So that tells us, and just like Robin Williams, that there are a lot of people out there who we think are great, but they're just masking it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so when I asked Donna about her story and to share it, one of the things she said, I'll just read from her story. She said, I said, just like I asked everyone, I said, tell me about your healing, tell me about your loss. And she said, what I want to tell you is different from the questions you are asking. When someone in our culture dies, we want to smooth things over. Everyone's focus is to encourage the grieving person to get over it.
Yeah.
They want to say something to placate the situation. People want reassurance. They want to hear the grieving person say, I'm okay, I'm moving on. And so we, the grievers, make moving on our project. The focus becomes, how do I move on? So she had good friends, she had tennis buddies, but she wasn't actually grieving. She was distracting herself. Her grief was so intense, she says she can hardly breathe for a whole week. Her entire body shut down. What had happened is her daughter had one suicide attempt where she crashed the car, but no one knew that was a suicide attempt except one friend. Mm-hmm. And then the second attempt, I suppose to make sure that it was effective, she set herself on fire in the garage. Mm-hmm. And her dad found her. And So Donna says her grief was so intense, her whole body shut down, and she wasn't eating, and finally she went and had a massage, and that opened up some spaces within her so that she was mm-hmm. able to eat food again. Mm-hmm. So when Donna shares her story, and there's a lot more to it, she talks about all the layers of grief, going through all that, and then she shares what she did find helpful. And what's interesting is she found this helpful 27 years later. You know, so grief isn't just this thing that happens and then goes away. It's this continuing thread in our life.
Yeah.
So what she was having, still having some issues with other family members and whatnot, and went to a therapist, and the therapist recommended she go to a ritual. And so she attended this ritual, and the first night they had their gathering, they got to know each other, they had their altars, and the woman who was leading the ritual the next morning said, you know, this was a quiet group. If you're really grieving, you're going to get into it. Hmm. And Donna says, it occurred to me that during the prior evening session, there had been a time when I wanted to scream. She says, the night Carol died, I remember my husband came and woke me. Hmm. He is the one who found Carol. I had been asleep. He said Carol was in the garage. I got up and headed in that direction. He stopped me at the dining room table and said, I'm not going to let you go in there. The ambulance was already there. I can remember taking hold of the chair with my hands. Probably if I'd tried, I could have broken it. I wanted to start screaming, but I knew if I started, I might never stop, so I didn't start. And she says, during the retreat, the memory of that night came back to me. I felt like I wanted to start screaming, but I just couldn't. Finally, I owned up to what I had experienced. The woman leading the retreat says, well, why didn't you scream? And she says, the group had been very quiet. I didn't want to be the only one screaming. And then she laughs. Then Donna says, the women on either side of me took my hands and said, if you will start, we will join you. When you're ready, go to the altar and we will be with you. And that's what we did. She says, these women didn't even know me, and yet I was free to fully grieve.
Why do you think there is still a stigma in this country, in this culture at least, regarding death? People do want to tend to avoid the mm-hmm. topic.
Well, I think it's a painful topic, so our natural inclination is, well, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to go there. It's painful. Mm-hmm. It's uncomfortable. It makes us uncomfortable. We don't want to hear about it. So we go maybe into denial, push it away. You know, but after talking to all these people and hearing their stories, it really is incredibly helpful to think about, and for a couple of reasons. One is it makes us aware of how precious life is and the people around us. It reminds us to tell the people in our lives that we love them. It reminds us not to take people for granted. Mm-hmm. And then our own, you know, mortality, it can be this call to say, well, what do I want to do with my life? What makes me happy? What's really important? You get down to what matters, and you get down to some very basic and important questions. And so even though the instinct might be, oh, I don't want to go there with that topic, going there is helpful. It really, really is incredibly helpful.
And it is the one thing that we all have in common.
Exactly.
We will all be and continue to be touched by death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Joining me in studio today is Diana Inson, author, speaker, facilitator. Her newest book is out. That's what we're talking about. It's called Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing. I highly recommend that you pick up a copy. We're going to continue more of this conversation, but first, here's another word from our sponsors.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
This program is sponsored in part by The Playful Soul, an event venue, yoga studio, art gallery, and boutique for your spirit. At The Playful Soul, you'll find books, candles, essential oils, jewelry, clothing, music, and meditation aids. Located in the Broad Ripple Village, they also offer meditation groups, dream groups, and book conversations. The address is 6516 North Ferguson. Their website is theplayfulsoul.com.
Welcome back to the program. Welcome to Journey's Fire. I'm Richard Brendan. My guest today is Dinah Ensign. She's been on before talking about her first one. This book is an intense read. It's a powerful book, powerful stories. And I love this book so much, Dinah, because I'm so into stories now, because everybody has stories they need to tell. Mm-hmm. And you have given, I'm thinking about the woman we talked about before the break, about Anonymous. You gave her space. Mm-hmm. And an opportunity to share her story where she might not have had that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really beautiful thing. We want to go to another story. You alluded to this earlier. There is a chapter called Caretaking. When I think about that, I think about some of the hospice background I've had. That's usually been my experience. Families, mm-hmm. loved ones mm-hmm. who are caretaking their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And you've got quite a few wonderful stories in here. But the one we chose also was, I believe, from Tom Robertson. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, the story's in the caretaking section. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts off with Joe, who talks about his mother and some of the family dynamics that go when one person steps in to be a caretaker and the challenges of that role. Janet, who lost both parents, just talks about how messy death can be, just like life. It's not always this peaceful, happy ending. Sometimes the person struggles mightily against it.
Yeah.
Refuses hospice, doesn't want to die, or is afraid of dying, or just doesn't have their life in a place where they're ready to let go.
And for the caretaker, it totally disrupts their lives, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. With Janet, she had her daughter she was raising. She was working. She's traveling to try and take care of her parents. One has dementia, you know, and then the same with Barry and Summer and Tom. They all have, you know, these where they're traveling and they're mm-hmm. trying to do jobs and trying mm-hmm. to maintain their families and also trying to help someone at the end of their life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With Tom, I believe mm-hmm. the story was about his dad. Is that right?
Yeah. Tom's dad got cancer and, like some of the other stories, he did not want hospice help. He was very adamant about that. And Tom and his wife had their dad live with them for a number of years, and they were trying to take care of him. And they had some conflicts, just in maybe generational, just lifestyle choices. And, you know, Tom and Stephanie were doing the best they could to take care of
his dad. Share mm-hmm. why his dad didn't want hospice.
You know, I think he knew that would be the end, and he did not want to go.
Yes, what people think. They think mm-hmm. that's like a death sentence.
Right. And that's it. I'm not ready. I'm not going. I refuse. And,
right.
you know,
okay.
So that's somewhat of a common theme with some of this.
Sure.
And and what Tom shares is the last day with his dad. I'll share a little bit of that. He says, his dad, when the end came, it came quickly. He says, by Friday of that week, he couldn't eat or go to the bathroom. We knew it was just a matter of days rather than weeks. And then he goes on to talk about that they had medicine that they had ordered, and he spent the whole day on the phone trying to get that medicine to come. You know, the people kept saying, we're on our way, we're on our way, we'll bring it. No, don't come and get it, we're on our way. And he said, literally, it was midnight when the medicine showed up, and his dad was near death, and then turns out it was suppositories. And he says, here we were in the room at midnight giving him suppositories. It was the absolute worst day. And then they finally went to bed, and Tom's father passed away. And he said then, you know, they thought, well, we were with him, we did the best we could. And then later they got a phone bill, and it was an out-of-state phone bill for a call at 2:00 in the morning. And Tom says, you know, who would place a call at 2:00 in the morning? They knew it wasn't them because they had gone to bed. They knew it wasn't his dad because his dad was dying. And so they called the number, and turns out it was a bookie. His dad loved horse racing. So as he's dying, kicking and screaming the whole way. The last thing he did before he died is he called the bookie to get the horse race results. And then Tom says, that just seems very appropriate. He went out doing what he loved, which was betting on the horse races.
Yeah, I was going to say, how perfect is that? But yeah. Leading up to that, and mm-hmm. you write about this as Tom mm-hmm. is sharing his story with you, he also had to deal with a lot of realities that I'm sure those of you who are listening today, maybe you're having to deal with that now, such as convincing a loved one you need hospice, or like Tom did, convincing mm-hmm. a loved one, I can't keep traveling down to where you live, you need to move. And that's right. very hard for a lot of people, because right. that's huge change mm-hmm. for them.
And giving up the driving, which is freedom, that came up a couple of times
I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. And mm-hmm. that's where I think the empathy needs to take place with a lot of people out right. there that we don't often have.
Yeah, it's challenging. Mm-hmm.
But the caretaking thing mm-hmm. chapter I enjoyed, because I think of so many people can relate to that, because mm-hmm. everyone will die, and a lot of people don't have that unexpected jolt. Mm-hmm. Many do. Mm-hmm. But many people are found in caretaking roles. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that can be exhausting as well.
Yeah. And one of the things I also wanted to mention that came up in Tom's story is, even though he and his dad did not have that sort of fantasy ending where someone goes peacefully into the night, mm-hmm. He was able to bring closure after his father passed away, mm-hmm. Because he went to a therapist and he was struggling with loneliness and, mm-hmm. you know, and the therapist said, I think it's because you didn't hear what you wanted to hear from your dad before he left. You know, mm-hmm. they never had that heartfelt conversation. In mm-hmm. fact, just the opposite. When he talked to his dad about hospice and caretaking, his dad said to him, boy, you and Stephanie just can't wait to get your hands on my money, can you? Mm. So, you know, it was very hurtful. And
yeah.
that's just, you know, family dynamics. And so what yeah. Tom was able to do is have a conversation with his dad after his dad passed and said, you know, I love you. I did the best I could. I know we pushed each other's buttons. It wasn't perfect, you know, but I hope you realize how much I love you. And earlier in the jolt section, Carla did the same thing. She mm-hmm. wrote a letter to express some of the things she couldn't express because the person had gone so suddenly. And so
yeah.
that's a point. We can resolve things even if the person is no longer here. We can have a different ending mm-hmm. if the ending that we had didn't turn out the way we would have liked.
Yeah, when I read that section where Tom's dad shared that with them, it reminded me of countless times I've heard other people share that with their family. Mm-hmm. The family had honorable intentions, were trying to help, but there was something in the brain of that loved one who knew they were going that mm-hmm. Maybe some distrust came in. But Tom also had suggestions for people in similar situation, caretaking situations. What did Tom share that he felt could be helpful for someone out there?
As far as taking someone into their home?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He said it's important both people are committed to having a family member move in with them, because it is challenging. So, you know, he mentioned with his dad, you know, he'd sort of be the bad cop and his wife would be the good cop, you know. So, but it's good to have both people on board and okay with that. And now her mother, in the story, he relates that her mother, when she's dying, you know, he's more of the bad cop, or she's the bad cop, and he, you know, just the switching yeah. of roles.
Roles reverse.
Right,
yeah.
exactly.
Exactly, yeah. yeah. We're going to continue on with these stories. I find them fascinating. The book is Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing. The author is with me in studio today, Diana Ensign. She's an author, speaker, facilitator. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll have more of the conversation.
Backpack safety. It's that time of year again. Your children are heading back to school with fresh supplies, fresh attitudes, and book bags that in some cases weigh more than they do. This is not okay for developing spines. As your children reach grade school age, you must teach them how to pack that book bag so it does not overly stress their spine. Remember the following tips. Pack largest and heaviest books against the back. Pack down and light from there. Be sure the bag is situated high enough on the back that it ends at the waist and not at the butt. Ensure that it is always carried on both shoulders. Backpacks should weigh no more than 10 to 15% of the child's weight. Parents, please don't think you can save money by buying a bigger backpack and letting your child use it for several years. The years between 10 and 15 are crucial to the overall health and growth of the spine, and if you have preteens and teens, you know that's when those bags are the heaviest. The statistic that more than one-third of childhood back pain is a result of overloaded and poor ergonomics of backpacks is a wake-up call for everyone. Protect those precious spines by having them checked by a chiropractor who's trained in pediatrics.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. It's a delight to have Diana Ensign make a return visit here. It's because she's written another book. So at the very end, we'll ask about the third book maybe down the road. But this one just came out. And towards the close of our time together, we'll share about opportunities people can have to meet you and also how they can get a copy of this book as well. Another chapter I want to talk about, then we'll highlight a story out of that. And again, all these chapters have a lot of stories in each one of them. And I think it's really going to be important for you, the listener, to pick up this copy because you have either already experienced loss, you're going through that right now, or you will, because death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth. It will affect all of us. And I, for one, found a lot of help from the suggestions and the stories of many of the people who are documented in here. This one chapter, which I just love the title of it, and that's The Precious Gift of Time. What a reminder we all need to have. It's also about letting go. Share a little bit about that section and all the stories that you put in there, and then let's hone in on one particular story.
The first part of Chapter 4 has a number of people who had a family member who had a serious illness. There's both challenges and gifts that come with that. And so the gift is you do have time to say goodbye. You do have an opportunity to spend time with the person. The challenge is you see the person suffering. You know, you see the person, Bonnie mentioned her daughter had cancer treatments that were incredibly painful. She said, my daughter had been through hell multiple times, you know, and as a parent, that's difficult to watch. And, you know, so each of these stories are about that process of seeing someone who's suffering. And then in the end, perhaps maybe you're sad to see them go, but there's also this sense of, well, at least they're not suffering anymore.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But we're going to talk about a story from David Traylor. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the second part of Chapter 4, the life lived well. And so those have a number of people where, and the same with the ones I mentioned, where where their life sets a model and example for all of us on how to live. And so David's story, his partner of 28 and a half years became ill, and they didn't know what it was. And so he had gone to a number of neurologists and MRIs and CAT scans and all of that before they finally diagnosed it, which was rapid onset MS. So all of that time, that 4.5 years of that illness, David says, you know, each day I lost a piece of him. And so he mourned that loss before it actually happened. And so when his partner finally passed away, you know, his friends were so worried that David was going to, you know, go to a dark place or, you know, and he said, my resolution was to become a survivor. I was grateful that his suffering was over. So, yeah, and the other part of David's story is because at the time of this, gay marriage had not been legalized, he was not permitted to make burial decisions or hospital decisions or he lost his home, the bank savings, everything to his partner's mother, even though they had been together 28 and a half years, almost 30 years in this committed relationship. So that's an added part to the grief is when we don't have any control over our loved one's care. You know, that can exacerbate the situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing I like about David's story is that not only does he have this tremendous capacity to love in a committed relationship, but then after his loved one passed away, down the road, then he started a new relationship. And so some of the people in this chapter are models for how to go forward after loss. And so in this new relationship that he has with Jonathan, you know, they talk about Bruce, and he says, about 8 months into the new relationship, he said, I decided it was time to introduce him and Bruce, the person who had passed away. He says, being an Orthodox Jew, Jonathan is familiar with rituals and traditions. I took Jonathan to the mausoleum. I got on a ladder and went through my little ritual, and Jonathan and I walked away. And then when Jonathan came down, he said, "Do you mind sharing with me what you said?" And, mm-hmm. and Jonathan replied, "I said, thank you." And he said, "That just meant the world to me." And so going forward in life with that capacity to love even after great loss, it's just a beautiful story.
And what was his way of coping with his grief? Because we've talked earlier in the program how everyone copes differently, and that's really borne out in all the stories that you've collected.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of his coping is to, you know, that mental attitude to decide that I'm going to be a survivor.
Yeah.
That's part of it. He also had some rituals he did, that helped him with that.
Yeah, rituals are really powerful, aren't mm-hmm. they? You talk about that in your first book a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a number of people in here mentioned how important rituals and symbolism are for remembering their loved one.
Yeah.
Hugely important. Mm-hmm.
You had another chapter, mm-hmm. Balm for the Soul, that speaks also about creativity, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And you also want to highlight, because we were trying to decide, there's so many stories in there, I wasn't sure what to pick, one from Meredith Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. This chapter, not everyone goes to a counselor, and counselors are wonderful, mm-hmm. and they offer mm-hmm. great tools, and I'm a big supporter and fan of anyone who's taken time to learn skills and pass them on. But not everyone finds that path helpful. And so in this chapter, there are a number of people, especially three college-age students in here, who found different paths to healing. Some is vocation choice, and some is artwork, mm-hmm. art therapy, things like that. And one example is Kate, who's a mixed media artist, and she says, you know, what helps me the most is doing what I love.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's just healing in itself. So Meredith, she's also a photographer. She writes children's stories. She leads active dreaming class. And she lost her husband when her child was about 6 years old. Her husband was on a plane and had a brain hemorrhage and was in a coma, never came out of the coma, and then passed away. And she went on to get her counseling degree. She said she dealt with that loss a lot with books, you know, sort of the thinking part of it. And then when she thought she was getting her life on track, she's beginning to move forward, she gets a call at work from her mom that her dad has killed himself. He's gone into the garage with a German Luger and shot himself. So then there's this whole new grief and this unexpected, painful emotion that happens with that. And then what she does is she starts more healing. So now she's going to, you know, Deepak for meditation and these other mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. And so when I met with her about her healing process, she wanted to share a dream with me that she had. And mm-hmm. she is in Robert Moss's active dreaming program. So she says, I had a dream about a very large, dark monster that had been trapped inside the hull of a ship. Mm. When I get to the ship, the top of the hull has been blown off, which is why I can see this creature. It scared me, of course, and I woke up. I said to myself, I need to re-enter this dream through shamanic journeying. I returned to the dream. I wrote everything down. In the dream, I slipped down into the platform next to the watering container where the creature is, and I asked, who are you? What are you here to show me? Are you in pain? I discovered in my conversation it was my father's dense energy, still very present in this level of reality. I needed to turn a red dial next to a platform so that dense energy could be dispersed into the water. Only everything was rusted, so I had trouble turning the dial. My father said, well, you have to use magic. And I asked, what magic? And he said, the magic of love. She said, the ending is beautiful. I cried and cried throughout the whole process, just saying, I love you, I love you. She said, I'm not crying from grief. I'm crying from relief. I've been carrying around anger and concealment. When we conceal our pain from the people who are our helpers, our therapists, our shamans, we don't give them the tools and information they need to help us because we're too afraid. We pick fear instead of love. She had that dream the night before we met.
Wow.
And she says she felt like she had that as a revelation to share with people in her story.
Wow. That's powerful. And also an example of yet another way that we can go through healing, but through dream. And there's so much more research coming out about that now, too.
And it's hard to go forward with any creative pursuit if you aren't doing the soul healing and the heart healing. That's one of the things that she shares. And certainly, like we mentioned in the beginning, if you can't even talk about it, if you don't even have the freedom to share with your loved ones, let alone, you know, anyone else, what's happened, you know, it makes it very hard to go forward then with your life and do the things that would bring meaning and hope to the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. You have another chapter. It's it's under faith. It's really about seeking answers. People being angry at God, it often happens. Forgiveness issues. And again, as your book discloses, people all come from different backgrounds, different faith backgrounds, what have you. Share a little bit about what you learned in that section, and then let's dial in to a particular story.
Sure. So chapter 6 is called A Deeper Faith. This is where someone has passed away, and what we do is we start asking questions about life and going through whether it's God or spirit or energy, whatever word you want to use, but but a higher source for guidance and for help. And so each of these people, their faith was very important to them in leading them toward healing. And as you mentioned, forgiveness of God or forgiveness of the person who caused the death or forgiveness of the person who passed all play a role. And so one of the stories in here is Vanessa, and her son had a car accident, and she's a very religious and spiritual person even before her son passed away. And so her story, her son is Mike Jr. He had good grades in high school. He was loved by his family. He was 20 years old. She says when Mike Jr. and his high school sweetheart were in college, she got pregnant. They were engaged to be married. They had a beautiful baby. She said it's not easy for African American men, and Mike Jr. was trying to do the right thing. They named the baby Devon. At first, they wanted to name him Divine, and I said he's already Divine, but that's not his name. So, you know, she said he was doing well at work. He was attending college. She says the day before the accident, he dropped me off at the beauty salon. He was late picking me up. Spirit said to me, "It's not important." She says Mike Jr. was very handsome. His nickname was Pretty because he was this boy with big eyes, dark hair, dark eyebrows, thick lashes, and green eyes. The beauty salon women took notice when he picked me up. He was taller than me, and he had a habit of putting his chin on my head and asking, "You good, Mom? Sorry I'm late." She said, I was upset, but I said, okay. It was a peaceful, beautiful day when he took me home. That day, he went to see people he normally didn't see. He stopped by to visit a cousin and his dad. He said, just stopping by to say hi. That was Friday. On Saturday, she got a call. She answered the phone, and they said, do you have a son named Michael Jr.? And she said, yes. And they said, he's been in an accident. And she said, I sat on the bed, and I thought, I need to put on clothes that match because Junior's such a stickler for that. I drove to the hospital. She said, it was like I was two people. The flesh one wanted to panic and rush. The spirit one said, it's okay. I got this. I drove calmly to the hospital. She said, I knew somehow that he had died. I called my daughter and Mike Jr.'s cousin and his dad, and then I went and saw my son. I was thankful that he looked asleep. He was on a ventilator, but there were no vital signs. His brain was dead. She said, I became the one to keep everyone else calm. There were two chaplains. One said, she's too calm. Give her some drugs. She said, I could hear them. The other one said, why give her drugs? She's calm. The doctor said I was in shock. I played music in the room and sat with my son. I said to myself, this battle is not yours, it's the Lord's. Other family members were in different places. They were young and didn't understand death. Several family members didn't want Mike Jr. removed from life support. I prayed about it. I said, Lord, he belongs to you, it's your will. That evening, the doctors removed the life support. It was a hard decision. No one wanted to let Mike Jr. go, but he was already gone. Then she says, afterward, they found out what happened. Mike Jr. had been driving. He was going through an intersection. A guy in a truck ran a red light. She says, normally Mike Jr. wore his seatbelt, but for some reason he didn't have his seatbelt on, and the impact of the truck threw him out the window on the driver's side, you know, and his head hit a water grid, and the car ran into the building. The ambulance came. It was daytime. The truck driver had been drinking. Devon was 18 months old when his father died. And so what Vanessa talks about in her story is forgiveness. And she says the family wanted to blame this truck driver who was drinking and killed her son. And she says she had to forgive him because, she says, put yourself in that man's place. He drinks because he's suffering. Him killing Mike Jr. is not his intention. He may have a family or kids. He didn't intend to kill someone. He's got to live with what he did. That's a living hell for him. You can't just talk God. When you get in that storm, it's a spiritual fight. You want to be pissed and blame somebody, but we are all born to die. Nobody gets to say when, where, or how.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, that's one of the toughest. I've heard a mom say when her son died, this is not supposed to be this way. Your kid is not supposed to die before me, for the parent. There are so many more stories we won't be able to get into today, but for our listeners, I really would encourage you to pick up a copy of this book. Not only for you, but also it'd be a great gift for people you know who are going through a tough time. This is very much a heart guide. And Diana, if people want a signed copy of Heart Guide, they can purchase that, I believe, by going to your website. Is that right?
Yep, just dianaensign.com.
And for those who are listening in the Indianapolis area, there are two upcoming events that are free and open to the public. One is an official book launch. When is that?
That's September 22nd at the Indiana Inner Church Center.
Okay.
That one's going to be sponsored by Overdose Lifeline.
Oh, wonderful. And the hours are 7 to 9 on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spirit in Place, which I can't believe it'll be here before we know it.
I know, it's coming up quickly.
You're going to be part of a panel program for that too.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that one will be November 10th on a Friday.
Okay. Diana Ensign, thank you so much for another beautiful book and also for sharing from this book with our listeners in the studio. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very grateful.
Okay, so let's take a breath and take a deep breath with me, friend. And I need you to hear this. It's okay. It's okay to miss them. It's okay to say their name. It's okay to cry. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to breathe deeply. It's okay to smile when you think of them. It's okay to function. It's okay to have days where you can't function. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be thankful. It's okay to love again. It's okay to remember. It's okay to hope. It's okay to be honest. It's okay to trust again. It's okay to pray. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. So give yourself permission. Give yourself permission to feel. Give yourself permission to love. Give yourself permission to ache. Give yourself permission to live. They would want that. They would want the best for you. They would want you to live fully. They would want you to love deeply. They would want you to laugh. They would want you to change this world with love. They would want you to give that love to others because they know the power of it. You, their hero. You, the love of their entire life. You, the one who will never stop saying their name. You, the one who is braving each day, putting one foot in front of the other, and living, even when part of you is worlds apart. You, the one who loves them endlessly. You, you're still standing. You, You're still breathing. You're making them proud, my friend. Now, in closing, here's a beautiful song from a group that I just heard of. They're called Vargo. Their album was produced by Sounds True, and this song is called Get Back to Serenity. Diana Ensign for joining us today. Her book is Heart Guide, True Stories of Grief and Healing. And that's today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.org. All shows are podcast on that site. And so for engineer Christopher Shoulders and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life one broadcast at a time.